Welcome in, everyone. Great to be with you today. Day after Election Day. Really big day for us here at News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. I'm Caleb Colquitt. As always, great to be in with you for another episode of Tactics. And we're going to talk about the tactics that worked, the tactics that didn't, all the fallout from the election. And I'm also going to do something that I don't usually do on here. I'm actually going to start national and work my way local, but there's a good reason for that. There's some strategy in that today. There was a tactic involved, if you will, for that. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to go ahead and jump into some of the national conversation, the national debate that we saw going on, and we're going to kind of work our way back to local because I think both are important, but the truth is I think the national implications are far more impactful just because when it came to the state, not a lot that was unexpected happened. It was mostly business as usual, mostly Republicans winning. There were very few people that even changed offices. Most of our incumbents wound up getting another term. And so we're going to go national first, and then we're going to work our way back and talk about what that says and what that means for the state of Alabama. One thing that I would want to mention before we go ahead and get into the meat and potatoes of what we're going to be talking about today is you can call in anytime. I would love to hear what your thoughts are on the election, what the results are. You can call in live right now, 860-1440. Our phone lines, as always, are available. That's 334-860-1440. Numbers right up there. Well, okay, I got the side right now. Okay, getting used to this video thing, starting to understand how to do video podcasting. So we appreciate you being patient with us, being patient with me as I learn how to do this and put this forward. So there's a lot of takeaways from last night's election, a lot of things that we could talk about today. One of the main things that I wanted to address here is I want to be honest about it because you guys know that even though I'm a partisan, I'm very clear and open about where my conservative political leanings are, my kind of libertarianism. And so you guys know I'm an opinion guy. I'm not a journalist. I'm not pretending to be objective. I'm not pretending to be this arbiter of truth that doesn't have a side. I got a dog in the fight, and y'all know that. And that's part of the reason that you tune in is because you do know that I have a dog in this fight. And that's where my perspective comes from. However, I'm going to be as objective as humanly possible, at least for me, and try to be honest about what exactly the implications for this particular election were. So based on my understanding of it, based on me as trying to look as objectively as possible as an outsider looking in, I think that what happened last night on the national stage is it proves that a couple of things. Primarily, that the blue wave was not nearly what they were predicting. Now, Republicans took pretty big losses, and that cannot be understated enough, that it was not a good night for Republicans. They still lost the House, and they lost the House by a fairly decent margin, not a massive margin, but a fairly decent margin. And so the fact that now to sort of impress upon you the severity of this, Nancy Pelosi is probably going to be Speaker of the House. That makes her third in line. If God forbid something happened to Donald Trump and Mike Pence, that would make Nancy Pelosi president. That's not good for anybody. That should really give you an idea of how bad this was last night. However, it was not nearly as bad as people were predicting it was going to be. And about 3, maybe 4 months ago, I would have been one of the people on the bandwagon saying, look, I don't want this to happen, but there's a very good chance that Democrats take the House by a very significant margin and probably wind up taking the Senate or at least breaking even in the Senate to where it would be 50-50. And that was what the conventional wisdom said at the time. 2016 had a lot of surprises. Last night had very few surprises. There were not a lot of races that went the opposite of the way they were predicted to go. And so that being said, the polling was pretty consistent and pretty reliable last night. And unfortunately, that meant that Democrats wound up doing very well, because if you're looking at the polling 3 or 4 months ago, they would have agreed with what I just said. But if you're looking at the polling in the past few weeks, they predicted pretty much exactly what happened. They predicted almost exactly what happened. And so that's something that is important to consider that the polling was pretty darn close on this one. And if you're looking at what actually happened, the results were that the Democrats gained about 27 seats, which last night somebody asked me my gut feeling, what do I think happens? I said, I think the Democrats gain anywhere between 25 to 30. Now, not all those races are decided. They're still counting in some places. Not all the precincts have reported. And so they could gain more than that. So we don't know exactly. But right now, the total stands as it is at 220 to 193 Democrat versus Republican. So the Democrats are currently winning by almost 27 seats. That's a big deal. And so that being said, this is not a good thing for the Republicans. Now, from a practical standpoint, honestly, I don't think it changes that much. And the reason that I say that is because the House Republicans have done virtually nothing with their power. They did get the tax cuts through, which were good, not substantial. I mean, a 2% cut across the board for everybody is not that big a deal. About the 20% cut on corporate taxes, that is a big deal, and that did really help. But you do that, and then you also weigh it against the fact that tariffs have started to tear into that economic growth to a degree, that even though we're absolutely destroying it in the jobs market, which is good. I mean, we have the lowest unemployment in years, record low unemployment. You're looking at the amount of our growth. It's not as good as it was in the second quarter this year, but still about a 3.5 growth rate in this country is nothing to sneeze at. And you're looking at the cutback on regulations, things like that. Those are all really good things. And that is to a degree to the credit of the House. But the idea that we have seriously rolled back Obama era administration and Obama era legislation, that's simply not true. Obamacare is still in place. The individual mandate is gone, but every other letter, there's like two sentences out of the thousands of pages in Obamacare that we were actually gotten rid of, that were actually repealed. Which, by the way, is also funny that in the last few days, the Democrats made this big pitch and their big final thing, this big issue that they tried to push them across the finish line, was healthcare. And what's funny about that is they were saying, oh, there's so many problems with healthcare. You idiots do realize that the healthcare system right now is Obamacare. They only repealed, like I said, about two sentences of that entire bill. And so the idea that Obamacare was done away with, that's not true. And so their big pitch was, there's so many problems. It's severely wrong. Our healthcare, there's so many things in it. Our system is so broken. You guys made the healthcare system we're in now. Democrats are the ones that set those policies in place. And so if you're complaining about the healthcare system as it stands right now today, you are complaining about a system that was created and enforced by Democrats. That to me was just hilarious. That was their big push that they were talking about in the last few days about our healthcare. That's the thing that we really want to emphasize because there's so many things that are wrong with it. You do realize what you're trying to do is saying, while Democrats were in power, we set up the system and it's failing miserably, so we would like you to put us back in power. I mean, that would be like let's say you're the star quarterback on a football team and you throw four interceptions, and so coach takes you out of the game, and a quarter later you say to the coach, you got to let me back in, you got to let me play. Well, why? Well, look at us. We're three touchdowns down. And he says, yeah, but you threw three pick sixes. So you're complaining about a problem that you created. And you're trying to use that as the leverage. You're using that as the reason to argue that you should be put back in charge again. That doesn't make any sense. So the whole thing was just really humorous. From that perspective, that the Democrats were begging people to put them back in power, and their primary motivation for that was to fix a system that we broke. It really was illogical, but I mean, apparently it did work for them because, like I said, they gained 27 seats in the House. And so you can't say that it wasn't effective because apparently there were enough people that were dumb enough to forget that this system that's only been in place and been fully implemented since 2014 was, you know, put together by the Democrats. And so evidently the pitch worked, whatever it was. And one thing that's significant about that as well is that there was this idea by a lot of people that were big Trump supporters, Trump loyalists, the people that I call the Trumpets, not the people that voted for Trump as a whole, but the people that are absolutely like Trump is the center of their universe and he's their guy. And that's their politician, the person that they want to pin all their hopes and dreams on, which is, I think, actually a fairly small amount of the GOP. But nonetheless, the people that were absolute Trump loyalists were bragging about how Wisconsin and Michigan are now going to be Republican strongholds because Trump brought them into the fold and made them into Republican states. That was completely disproven last night. Michigan and Wisconsin went overwhelmingly blue in their governor races, in their House races. And so really what that proved is that while there's been some encouraging numbers on conservatism, you've got a conservative rock star like Scott Walker that wound up losing his governor seat last night, which is unfortunate because Scott Walker's really good. One of the very few people that I consider an actual constitutional conservative in the GOP. But nonetheless, so that's what you're looking at right now. It did kind of disprove that theory that now the Rust Belt is going to be a stronghold for Republicans. Maybe it could still be someday, but the point is it ain't there yet. If that is eventually what's going to happen, it's certainly not there yet, and there's certainly work to be done in that particular area. So another thing that's really interesting to look at the implications of this election as a whole is that, by and large, socialism lost. And don't get me wrong, the Democrats being in power in the House is not a good thing. But if you're looking at the candidates on the Democrat side that won versus the ones that lost, unless you're talking about somewhere that is just uber, uber liberal, like the district, for example, that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won, unless you're looking at a district that is just super deep blue and they'd vote for anybody that's not a Republican, by and large, the candidates that went the more traditional route wound up winning. The candidates that wound up going for the more moderate, let's embrace some free market ideas candidates, those guys did much better than the ones that were talking about democratic socialism. And so when you're looking at districts that are real, actually purple, that were actually up for grabs, it seems as though pushing the idea of democratic socialism wound up actually hurting the Democrats in the race overall. And most of the candidates that embrace socialism, for example, Andrew Gillum, the guy who's running for governor down in Florida, that he's about as far left as you get. And still, DeSantis, who by no means I think is a great candidate for governor, he still wound up pulling out a win. And it looks as though, even though it's not technically been called yet, right now the numbers are favoring the Republican candidate for governor in Georgia as well. And so the candidates that went full on socialism, it's spooky to me that they had any showing whatsoever, don't get me wrong, but it looks as though the more traditional, the more blue dog Democrat, the people that broke in that direction, actually wound up doing much better on the national scale than you would if you were looking at Democrat-centric, very liberal districts. So just looking at it from the onset, looking at it again, trying to be as objective as possible, it looks like the vast majority of Americans in the middle of the country are certainly not on board with or not going to be accepting of any form of socialism, at least not anytime soon. Now, when I say anytime soon, 4-8 years from now, that might change. But right now, it seems to be in the Democrats' favor to moderate and go to the middle. The candidates that were more extreme tended to not do so well last night. So let's talk about the Senate here. The Republicans actually, this was, in my opinion, the biggest surprise, because we all knew that they were going to hold the Senate, or we all knew that there was a good chance, I should say, that they would hold the Senate, but virtually nobody expected them to actually make gains in the Senate, myself included. But Republicans have gained 2 seats. Now, they did lose a seat, so they actually gained 3 seats and then lost one that was Republican previously, but a net gain of 2. So Republicans have gained seats. Right now it stands 51-45, and you're like, hey, Caleb, that doesn't add up to 100. I know it doesn't. There's 4 races that are still up for grabs that are still kind of a toss-up at this point, and we'll report on those as soon as we find them out. We did lose 1 Senate seat in Nevada, and so that was a little bit strange that Nevada wound up going blue, which that was kind of unexpected, but you know, it's Nevada. Nevada's always been weird. It's one of the few truly purple states where you could, I mean, you can flip a coin and basically try to predict Nevada. So in Nevada, we did lose one. And this really goes back to the, in my opinion, the biggest takeaway of the whole thing, which is the biggest winner of last night was Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell, Cocaine Mitch. Cocaine Mitch was by far the biggest winner last night. And the reason that Cocaine Mitch was so thrilled, just did a line of cocaine and then came out and was talking. Look, this was the best possible scenario for Mitch McConnell. And the reason is because he has a stronger majority in the Senate. He gets to keep his job. And now he has a Democrat House that he can blame. I said this 2 or 3 days ago, I think. Mitch McConnell is on his knees praying that the Democrats take the House, because then he has somebody to blame. He has a villain in the room. That's where he shines. You remember that Cocaine Mitch was the whiner in chief when it came to not having a majority in the Senate and saying, well, you only have one half of one branch of government. And Mitch McConnell, that's who he is. He's the guy is great at making excuses. The guy is phenomenal at making excuses. And now he has a built-in excuse. Now he can say, well, we can't do anything. The Democrats keep sending us bad bills. What do you want us to do? And so really, broken government, government that is in inaction, which, by the way, is not a completely bad thing, but that's a subject for another day. Essentially not being able to get bills through and being able to do virtually nothing while being able to blame doing nothing on the other side and the other guys, that is Mitch McConnell's dream come true. Because the guy's not a conservative. He's not about getting a conservative agenda through. He's not about doing a bunch of things that he can pin his hat on. Mitch McConnell does two things. He raises money to bring back to Kentucky that helps him get reelected, and he complains about the Democrats. That's all he really does. And now he has a legitimate built-in excuse for why all the bills coming out of the Senate suck. And, I mean, really, if you ask me, Mitch McConnell is by far the biggest winner of last night's election, because everything that could have gone right for him went right for him. And like I said, the blue wave was really more like a blue squirt gun. You were expecting this tsunami of blue to sweep over the Senate, sweep over the House. I was skeptical of that from the very beginning. There were some poll numbers that had me a little worried in the Senate, but by and large, it wound up just being more of a splash in the face, like from a glass of water or a squirt gun, than it wound up being an actual wave. And that really was the takeaway. Still not nice to get hit in the face. I mean, like I was giving this analogy last night on Twitter. It's basically like finding out you got a malignant tumor. I mean, you're thrilled to death that it's not cancer. You're thrilled to death that the Republicans still have the Senate. You're still going to be able to stop the Democrats from getting their agenda through, that they have such a narrow margin that they're not going to be able to get some of their more radical policies through. But you still got a malignant tumor, which means you got to get it removed. And that's no fun. So even though you're thrilled that it's not the worst case scenario, it's kind of hard to be excited about the outcome that you did have, because it's still not good for you. So that's really the best analogy I give. And one thing that really did scare me last night was Ted Cruz, because up until late into the evening, you were worried that Ted Cruz was not going to make it. It was a narrow victory ahead of Beto O'Rourke, or as I like to call him, Robert Francis O'Rourke, because that's his real name. So Bob, which is like the whitest white guy name ever, Bob O'Rourke, who is on the campaign trail, a thoroughly white Irishman trying to pretend to be Hispanic. Bob O'Rourke lost to Ted Cruz last night, and he's not going to go away. I'm sure that because the Democrats sunk so much money into him and so much time and effort into him, they're going to want to use him on a national scale in some capacity. But I was thrilled because the fact that a Democrat came that close to winning a statewide election against a Republican in Texas should be frightening to everyone. And if you're looking at the breakup of how Texas voted, you'll notice that there's a lot of blue patches along that border, which means that the Democrats' policies of not enforcing the border have been very effective in trying to flip Texas, because it's the people that are coming in, anchor babies, people that are voting in that way that are moving towards a blue Texas. And like I said before, if they flip Texas, we will not have a Republican president for about 2 decades because of the way the Electoral College works. And when it comes to the House, that will be disastrous if all of a sudden a majority of the Texas delegation winds up being Democrats. That is not good for Republicans on the national scale. If they flip Texas, and Democrats know this, and that's why they're trying so hard to get to Texas, if they flip Texas, they've got the reins of power basically guaranteed for another 2, maybe 3 decades. And that's why it is so terrifying to think that they defeated, or almost defeated, Ted Cruz, who is arguably the second most conservative member of the Senate. I mean, Ted Cruz is phenomenal. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that people in his own party, and when I say people, I mean Donald Trump, were trying to excoriate him, trying to make him out to be a liar. And there were, I'm sure, a lot of Trump people that either didn't vote for Ted Cruz or wound up doing something else. And that's part of the reason, not the only reason, but that is part of the reason that it came very close in the night that Beto O'Rourke came within an eyelash of beating him. And that should be terrifying to everybody that actually cares about the Constitution, that cares about conservatism. Although I will say this, one thing that I think is a big help to that is a good talking point, I guess, to bring out of this is that Democrats have been complaining and whining for years, especially since the Citizens United Supreme Court case, that people can just buy elections. You're buying the election. You're spending all this money and you're just buying the election, and people can buy elections, and that's how elections are decided. Whoever spent more wins. Well, I mean, usually that is true. But if there was ever a case study of how you cannot buy an election, Ted Cruz winning last night was the epitome of that. Because the Democrats spent $70 million on Bob O'Rourke's campaign. $70 million. That is the most any Senate candidate has ever spent on a campaign in history. And he lost. And the truth is, ironically, Donald Trump is also kind of a smash in the face to that theory. And the reason that he is because Donald Trump spent virtually no money on his campaign and just destroyed Hillary Clinton. At least if you're looking at it from the Electoral College standpoint, which is the only score that matters. If you're looking at Donald Trump's campaign and thinking, well, you know, you got to look at it from the standpoint that money just buys elections. Look, Beto O'Rourke got millions of dollars in free advertising from the national media, from media there in Texas. All the media was behind him. And then he also got $70 million to spend on campaign ads and campaign events and everything else. And the dude still lost. If there was ever a case study to say, no, you can outspend your opponent by quite a bit and still lose the election, Ted Cruz winning that election last night should be able to put that to rest. Now, I know the Democrats are never going to shut up about it. They're going to continue pushing this lie that you can just buy elections. Although I do think it's funny that they're the ones always complaining about buying elections, and they seem to still always spend more on elections than Republicans. I mean, you look at Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, those are the two highest presidential candidates when it comes to spending on a campaign that there's ever been, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Now, of course, the difference is Barack Obama won and Hillary Clinton lost, but the thing is, it's hilarious to watch the Democrats complain about people buying elections when, if you're looking at it from that standpoint, the highest amount of money ever spent on a Senate campaign was Beto O'Rourke, and the highest ever spent on a presidential campaign was Hillary Clinton. So it is really kind of humorous to see them complain about money in politics, considering they run a lot of the money in politics. They act as though they don't. But a couple of other things that I noticed. The senators that voted against Brett Kavanaugh in his confirmation were the ones that lost. Joe Manchin in West Virginia wound up winning. He voted to confirm Kavanaugh. Now, he waited till the very last second and knew that his vote wasn't going to make a difference. But the point is, he voted for Kavanaugh to ingratiate himself to Trump voters, and apparently it worked. Because even despite West Virginia being as red as it is, Joe Manchin is still the senator from West Virginia. Heidi Heitkamp, on the other hand, from North Dakota, she voted against Kavanaugh and wound up losing. And so the senators that voted for Kavanaugh wound up winning their races. And that also is a cautionary tale. Democrats lost their freaking minds over that whole thing, through the idea of presumption of innocence completely out the window. And to moderate voters, people in the middle that were watching this and didn't have a real strong feelings about it one way or the other, they were looking at the Democrats and thinking, these people are crazy. And if you look at it in retrospect, just from looking at it strictly from a political standpoint, the Kavanaugh hearings were a disaster for Democrats. In fact, there probably would have been a legitimate blue wave had it not been for Kavanaugh. That's when the polls started turning against the Democrats in the generic ballot. So Kavanaugh and the circus that it was, as insane and frustrating as it was, it actually wound up helping Republicans to a great degree in this election. And finally, this is another thing that I just had to mention. Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee wound up winning her Senate race by a pretty significant amount. So Marsha Blackburn is now the reason for the teardrops on Taylor Swift's guitar. Because you all know that Taylor Swift launched a campaign against Marsha Blackburn. She was talking about how terrible she was, and which is hilarious that she was talking about Marsha Blackburn being a sexist and being against women's rights when she was supporting an old white dude that was running against Marsha Blackburn, which is what the Democrats always fuss at Republicans for doing. But anyway, you notice that Marsha Blackburn didn't come out and say, well, the only reason anyone would ever vote against me was because they're sexist, which is exactly what Hillary Clinton said, which really does show the difference in Republicans and Democrats. Democrats, if you don't like them, it can't be because their policies suck. It can't be because you have ideological differences. It must be because you have something against their race, their sex, their sexual orientation, any of those things. I mean, I remember anybody that criticized Barack Obama, it had to be because they hated black people, even if you were black. So it really was just humorous. T-Swift, the first endeavor that she has, the first undertaking in the political realm, she goes against Marsha Blackburn hard and fast and winds up losing anyway. So that was pretty hilarious. And finally, one thing that I'm actually legitimately, and I'm not trying to be sarcastic, I'm legitimately excited about this because this seat was going to go to a Democrat regardless of who it was, and the vote's not going to change that much. I'm actually really glad that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wound up winning the seat last night, even though it wasn't really much of a contest. She was in a very liberal district, because she is going to be a thrill and delight to cover for the next 2 years. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is the youngest person to ever be elected to Congress, which goes to show you that newer isn't necessarily always better. And I'm sure that she'll be inaugurated, to use her word, she'll be inaugurated and sworn in, and she's going to be signing stuff into law. I'm still convinced that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez thinks that she's the president or something, because she says she's going to be inaugurated and then start signing bills into law. Very confused young lady, which, by the way, I think goes to prove that you do not need an intellect, a basic working knowledge of American civics, experience, knowledge, none of those things matter in an election. You can be a member of Congress without all of those things, which I think should go to show and help us remember that these guys up in Washington, they're not necessarily geniuses. They're not better than us. When you've got Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez sitting in as a member of the House of Representatives for the United States, you can rest assured that if nothing else is a case study, that these guys aren't necessarily geniuses. Just because they have a fancy title and live in D.C. does not make them... this chick's, she's as dumb as a sack of hammers. And just to kind of illustrate my point, they were asking her maybe 4 or 5 days ago, they were asking her how she plans to pay for Medicare for All, when there were Democrat sources that are suggesting at minimum that her plan would cost about $32 trillion over the next 10 years. And when asked how she was going to pay for it, she said, well, we'll just pay for it. I mean, it really was like that. She said well, when the rent goes down, you just pay for it. Well, you still have to get that rent money from somewhere. Even if the rent goes down, which government taking control of a of a sector of the economy has never made costs go down at any point in human history. And that's not just exclusive to America. That's anywhere. Show me the industry that the government took over that costs went down and services went up. You can't do it. It's impossible. Even in healthcare services that actually work pretty well, like Switzerland, where they do have a single-payer healthcare system, guess what? They pay through the nose for it. I mean, they pay a ton of money for their healthcare. And it's a good system. But it costs a lot of money, a lot more than a private system would. And so what you're talking about here, what you're talking about bringing here, is, again, at minimum $32 million, and that's lowballing it. That's from a left-leaning source. And her answer to it is, well, we'll just pay for it. Well, that money has to come from somewhere, sweetheart. And I'm sorry, I know that you're young and cute and attractive and you know all the buzzwords to say to get yourself elected in an uber liberal district of people that don't mind referring to themselves as socialist, but you wanting money to exist does not make it exist. You can't just make things cheaper. And so that is going to be really fun. Going on to the local elections, very little surprising happened yesterday. I mean, very little. Virtually everybody that was an incumbent wound up winning. The Republicans, by and large, had a very, very strong showing by wide margins, which it's a very red state. That's kind of what you expected. But I think that that actually, in and of itself, is significant because there was this theory amongst some Democrats in the state. I won't say that it's necessarily a widely held belief, but there were a lot of people that were very optimistic about this after Doug Jones wound up winning the Senate seat. And like I said, right after that election, this does not mean that Alabama has suddenly become sympathetic to a lot of the arguments when it comes to Democrats. Alabama is not now a light red state or a moderate state. None of that's true. Roy Moore was a ridiculously flawed candidate that had a lot of baggage that a lot of Republicans didn't even like. I'm not saying that I was among them because, you know, I think the judge has done some things that I disagreed with, some things that I really did agree with. And but his approach rubbed some people the wrong way. And because of that, and because there's a long history there, this is one of the reasons that I was a big fan of Mo Brooks as opposed to Roy Moore for being in that position. But, you know, when it came to that, they were convinced that because of that, that because Doug Jones won, that now all of a sudden Democrats could win and they were going to have a much stronger showing in the next election. Sorry, didn't happen. Now, actually, what may have taken place, and I think that there was at least an aspect of this, I don't know if it was necessarily a major contributing factor, but Doug Jones getting elected probably helped the Republicans in this election because Alabamians were looking at that and thinking, oh, whether or not I vote actually does matter. And so I think that motivated some people to get off their couches and actually go and vote. So there was virtually no turnover whatsoever when it came to new officers. John Merrill is still the Secretary of State. Kay Ivey is still the governor. We do have a new lieutenant governor in Will Ainsworth. We do have a new commissioner of agriculture in Rick Pate. And John McMillan, who used to be the commissioner of agriculture, is now our state treasurer. Jim Ziegler is still the auditor, which, you know, big congratulations to Jim Ziegler. And I'm actually kind of surprised that John from Millbrook didn't call in just now to talk about Jim Ziegler. But 860-1440, if you do want to talk about that. And, you know, just everything went basically as expected in the state of Alabama. There was very few surprises in last night's election. I can't even actually even think of a surprise. But I do want to get to some of the politics. Governor Ivey's speech was kind of meh. But that's just the kind of that's the way Governor Ivey is. I'm not saying that because I'm trying to go after anything, but like I said before, Kay Ivey is very much a mixed bag. She does some things that I like, some things that I don't. The woman's not a brilliant speaker. She's not great at pushing her ideas and putting them forward, which is part of the reason she avoided debates like the plague while she was in the campaign. But, you know, Governor Ivey's speech, and I voted for her. I'm glad she won. I was pulling for her. But she's not bombastic. She's not somebody that can rally the troops. That's just not who she is. She kind of does a don't rock the boat routine, which personally I find kind of annoying because it, I don't know, kind of clashes with my personality or something. But as far as policy goes, there's a lot of things that she's done that I think is really good. her speech didn't have a lot of substance. She was just kind of a generic, all right, let's get Alabama working again. Thanks to everybody. So there was nothing wrong with it. It wasn't a bad speech. Didn't really blow me away, though. I will say this about Walt Maddox, and I'm glad that he is not our governor because of some of his policies. But I got to say, his concession speech was phenomenal. Very magnanimous, very generous. You didn't get the sense that he didn't want to win. You didn't get the sense that he was like relieved that he didn't get the governorship, because you could tell that he wanted it. But you could also tell that he was mature about it. He handled it about as well as I've ever seen anybody give a concession speech. And that is high praise for Walt Maddox. Even though I didn't like a lot of his things on policy, super nice guy, somebody that I would have no problem getting together and having a long conversation with. And he's a smart guy, somebody that I could sit and have that long conversation with and be mentally stimulated for a long time. So the guy's kind of a policy wonk. And even though I disagree with some of his views and some of his principles, I don't agree with him on some issues, especially when it comes to abortion, even though I agree with him far more than I do most Democrats on that issue. When it comes to a lot of other issues like spending, the Medicaid expansion, I thought he was the wrong guy for the job, but dang it, that was a good speech. That was a very good speech. And honestly, if a lot of people were basing this on charisma, if people were basing it on his ability to communicate his message to people, Walt Maddox would have won that election. But it's the wrong message. He's in the wrong state. Honestly, if he were in a different state, he probably would be holding a very high office, like a statewide office or a governorship in a different state, in a blue state. Because I think he's got the intellect for the job. I just think that, you know, because of the way Alabama is, and I'm glad Alabama is this way, there wasn't a lot of chance that he was going to wind up winning that seat. So even though I'm glad Walt Maddox didn't win, I was pulling for Kay Ivey, you got to give the guy credit where credit is due. And speaking of concession speeches, one thing that struck me as weird, Martha Roby, who I've made no secret about my disdain for Martha Roby, can't stand her. I hate the fact that she's my representative in the House. But nonetheless, Martha Roby, you know, good old F rating from Conservative Review, Martha Roby, she wound up winning. Yay. I mean, I didn't want Tabitha Eisner to win either, but there were just no good options in that race. Martha Roby is not a good option. She's not a conservative. She votes with the Democrats about half the time. So I don't know. It's whatever. I really didn't care what the outcome of that race is. The one thing that is funny is Martha Roby is just petrified of media. Last night, she didn't even have a watch party. She just issued a statement from her house, which you're watching the results with your family. That's fine. And she was very confident she was going to win. I get it. But at the same time, like, Martha, can you never speak to anybody about the job that you're doing up there? I mean, give an interview to someone. And she avoids talk radio like the plague because she knows we'll actually ask her tough questions. She won't come on with me. She won't come on with Kevin. She won't come on with Matt Murphy. That woman will not speak to anybody about her policies because she knows the second that she does, they're going to ask her about her terrible voting record. And that's not good for her. So she figures, why bother? The second she got in office, that was the end of her relationship with the media, at least here in the state of Alabama. So Martha Roby doing what was politically probably smart, which is not getting in front of the camera. Tabitha Eisner, though, I will say this about Tabitha Eisner's speech. I'll start out with the positive. I really did appreciate during her campaign and also during her speech, the call for civility. She said that it's wrong when Democrats vilify their opponents, and it's wrong when Republicans do the same thing, too. And she's absolutely right about that. We have an unfortunate tendency in the United States now to demonize and belittle our opponents. It's one thing to say you disagree with their ideas. It's another thing to say that they themselves are wicked and want and need to be stopped. Now, there are occasions where there are legitimately people with evil intent that I think you do have to bring that up. But needlessly vilifying them or doing so to score political points, I don't think that that's right. And I did appreciate Tabitha Eisner's approach when it came to that. But one thing that I did have to mention, I know she was running a very low budget campaign, but good gracious, it looked like she was giving that speech in a trailer park. Like, behind her, you could see like the corner of a house and a storm drain and the gutters on the side of the house. And I was thinking, did she do this in a trailer park? Where is she? You couldn't find a better backdrop than that, or at least a better lit backdrop than that. You could barely see her. I get that you're running a low budget campaign, but I mean, I put together this whole setup. I mean, not the studio, obviously, that's the radio studio, but I put together the cameras and everything for like $50. I mean, come on, Tabitha Eisner. You can at least shell out $50 to get a decent backdrop or something. I don't know. But I don't know. I just thought that was funny. But overall, her speech was pretty good, even though I agree with her on basically nothing, but her call to civility, I thought, was very much welcome and needed. And I thought that she actually did say the right thing when it came to that. Okay, so also in the House, Mike Rogers wound up beating Mallory Hagan. Again, Mike Rogers is barely maybe a notch ahead of Martha Roby, in my opinion, when it comes to the Alabama delegation. The guy votes with the Democrats most of the time. Those two are the definition of rhinos, the definition of swamp people. But one thing that is really good that came out of that election that I'm actually a little bit more excited about him winning than I am about Martha Roby winning is I never have to hear Mallory Hagan spout off about how terrible and backwards this state is. And that's one strategy that I don't understand. Now, apparently it can work in some scenarios. Like I said, Doug Jones basically said exactly the same thing and he wound up winning somehow. But I've never understood the idea that you talk about how much you hate the place that you want to go represent in Washington. Mallory Hagan routinely talked about how terrible Alabama was, how backwards it is, and how much she liked New York so much better than that. That attitude just really gets under my skin. Does Alabama have problems? Absolutely. Are there things that I would change about it? Sure. But I don't hate where I'm from. I'm proud to be from Alabama. I'm proud to be from the South. I'm proud that we have family values and we have sort of an antiquated way of looking at things. If that antiquated way of looking at things is talking about believing in the Bible, believing in American exceptionalism, those are all things that I'm proud of and I am glad to have that heritage. And you know what? If I didn't, I would move somewhere else that has a heritage I associate with more. And that's what Mallory Hagan did, and then she saw that the taxes were killing her, and so she moved back to Alabama. And so that's really the irony in this whole thing. So if nothing else, I'm just thrilled that I don't have to hear anything else out of Mallory Hagan ever again. So that was a good thing that came out of that. Congratulations to some of the others that won. Attorney General Marshall, that guy's been through just an awful ordeal with his family. And the fact that he was able to soldier on and continue to go through the campaign, there's nobody more deserving to be the Attorney General, in my opinion, based on the way he conducted and carried himself after that tragedy with his wife committing suicide. And our prayers go out to that family. The way they were able to stick together and finish strong in this particular campaign, I think, was nothing short of heroic. And so congratulations, Steve Marshall. You deserve it. We're all looking to you to do a good job in the Attorney General's office in the state of Alabama and wish you the best of luck. When it comes to Tom Parker, Tom Parker is going to be our new Supreme Court Chief Justice. There's nobody more deserving than him. The judicial experience, the originalism, the textualism that comes out of that guy, I mean, it's unparalleled. He is as good as any of the Supreme Court justices that we have, and I do not say that lightly. In fact, I would have no problem with, and I would think it would be appropriate for Tom Parker to be a Supreme Court Supreme Court Justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, but very glad to have him at the helm, very glad to have him in the most powerful position in the Supreme Court of the state of Alabama, and looking forward to him continuing to give good opinions and to be able to lead the court in that way. So congratulations to Justice Parker on that. And finally, before we go on to our daily dose of stupid, all four amendments passed. This was something that really wasn't much of a surprise. For whatever reason, in the state of Alabama, it seems like nobody ever wants to vote against any of our constitutional amendments. And the last time I remember us voting against an amendment, one had to do with taxes, the other one had to do with the lottery. So, and that was a long time ago. That was before I could even vote because I didn't participate in those elections. I'm only 29 years old. So that being said, I don't know what it is, but the threshold of stupidity for an amendment to be failed is pretty high. Now, this particular batch of amendments, really glad that Amendment 2 passed. I'm okay with Amendment 4 passing. I don't care about Amendment 3. Amendment 1, I was back and forth on the whole thing with the Ten Commandments. And if you want to see my rationale behind that, go back to yesterday's show, because I give an in-depth explanation, which I'm not going to repeat here. But I just waffled back and forth on that when I wasn't really sure about it. But to be honest, I'm fine with it passing. I thought that it was kind of redundant. I thought that it wasn't necessarily something that we needed. But that's the thing about it being redundant. You may not need a second of whatever it is. You may not need a second, you know, frying pan or whatever else it is, but you're not bothered by having it. So I wasn't really upset that it passed. I voted no because I felt it was kind of frivolous. But, you know, it's fine. And obviously I have no problem with what it says. I have no problem with the wording of the amendment. So I'm okay with that one passing, and I'm really glad Amendment 2 passed. That to me is a signal that, well, the rest of the country actually is moving in a more pro-life direction, but the rest of the country can do what it wants. In the state of Alabama, we value life and we value the people that cannot speak for themselves, the most innocent and the most helpless among us, and that is the people in the womb, the unborn. And that is one reason that today I am very proud of my state for passing that amendment. And I hope, and it is my fervent prayer, that when Roe v. Wade is overturned, and one thing that that amendment does is it basically implies that once Roe v. Wade is gone, abortion is gone in the state of Alabama. And so let's hope and pray that Brett Kavanaugh being on the court is what tips it in that favor, because if Roe v. Wade goes away, based on my understanding of how that amendment reads, day one, abortion is legal in the state of Alabama. Maybe there's an attorney that understands that a little bit better, and that may not be the case, but that's what I'm hoping for. I hope that's the way that the court sees it. And if that is the case, then I'm very, very proud of my state, and I will be thrilled to be the first state in the union that outlaws the barbaric and horrific practice of abortion. So that being said, we're going to go ahead and jump to the daily dose of stupid.
Now you messed it up. You're stupid.
All right, so the daily dose of stupid today, Van Jones, which had I the daily dose of stupid before just a few days ago, probably would have been the subject of quite a few daily doses of stupid. But Van Jones, just by any stretch of the imagination, is a pretty terrible human being. He's a self-proclaimed communist, and he's waffled back and forth on whether he's really a communist or not. But out of all the people in Barack Obama's cabinet, I consider him to be one of the absolute worst. And that's setting the bar incredibly low. Last night, he made a comment that did make my blood boil just a little bit, talking about dog whistles and how racist the president is and how he was upset. And it was, according to him, heartbreaking that we didn't have the big blue wave that he was hoping for. And what he said was, we were hoping that the antibodies would kick in and that would basically reset the country and move it away from Donald Trump. Because again, Van Jones is incapable of seeing anything except through the lens of racism and Donald Trump. And so he conflates even those two things. But to suggest, because I understand people being upset when an election doesn't go their way, that I get. But to suggest that the antibodies were supposed to kick in implies what? That the people that supported the president and supported his agenda are a disease. They are a blight. They are a plague on this country. That is what Van Jones is suggesting by choosing those words. And you can talk about Donald Trump being divisive all you want, and goodness knows he is. I'm not saying that he's not divisive. But you can talk about Donald Trump being divisive all you want, but when you are referring to roughly half the country as a disease that you are hoping the antibodies kick in and destroy, because that's what antibodies do when an infection enters the body, you can't preach to other people about being divisive. When you view other people, when you view roughly, like I said, half the country as something that needs to be gotten rid of, you're the one that's divisive. And that really is one of the dumbest comments that I've heard. He says the antibodies against hate. Again, if you're the one that's suggesting that half the country is a disease that needs to be kicked out, you're the one that is engaged in hate. And that is the height of irony when it comes to Van Jones the other night giving his commentary on CNN. Look, I didn't vote for the president. I don't support a lot of the things that the president has done. He and I see differently on a lot of issues, including to a limited extent, some on international trade. I don't like the way that he uses his language. I don't like the way that he just trolls people for no reason. I don't like the way that he treats people. I don't like, you know, him from a moral standpoint, some of the things in his past. But nonetheless, I do not, because of those things, assume that every single person that did vote for him or did support him is a disease that needs to be gotten rid of. And when you're doing that, you are practicing hate. You are assuming the absolute worst in people. And especially coming from somebody like Van Jones, that in his mind, the only reason, and he said this, the only reason that anybody could have voted against Barack Obama was because they hate black people. Then you are the one that has a prejudice. You are the one that is assuming the worst possible scenario in a large chunk of the country, a large plurality of the American people. And that's why when it comes to Van Jones, I've got no use for the guy, because that's somebody whose mind cannot be changed. I'd like to believe that he could. And, you know, as a Christian, I believe that anybody can change through the power of Jesus Christ. But that is someone who, at least the attitude that he has now, is not willing to listen or even consider the other side. And that's the reason that I say that Van Jones is absolutely every evil, wicked thing that he claims is the problem in Trump's base. Everything that he complains about judging people based on their skin tone, not saying that they do it, I'm saying that that's what he accuses them of. Van Jones does all of those things, and that's why he is the subject of our Daily Dose of Stupid. So let's go ahead and move on to something far more uplifting. Let's go to the chaplain's report.
In 1775, the Continental Congress created the Chaplain Corps. Under the command of General George Washington, each soldier was required to attend worship service every Sunday. While other armies advanced on their feet, Washington's troops advanced on their knees. It's time for the Chaplain's Report with Caleb Colquitt on tactics.
All right, so subject of the Chaplain's Report today, I thought this was appropriate since we just had an election, we've got some new people in office. If you go to Romans 13, verses 1 and 2, and really this whole, I guess it's the first 7, maybe 8 verses in this chapter, are a really great commentary by the Apostle Paul on how we're supposed to deal with earthly powers. And so he writes in Romans 13, 1 through 2, "Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has oppressed the ordinance of God, opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves." Now, this is a verse that is very difficult to really follow. It's kind of like the game of chess. Very easy to comprehend, very difficult to actually follow and implement and master. And so, when looking at this, we know that whether or not the elections turned out our way or not, whether or not we're actually going to get the leaders that we want, we do, as Christians, have an obligation to respect the authority that they've been given. And part of the reason, the rationale that Paul gives in the book of Romans, is because that power does come from God. God is the source of all power and all authority. Therefore, any power or authority that any human has, God has allowed them to have. Doesn't mean that he necessarily condones everything they do. Doesn't mean that he would have been the choice that God himself would have made. But he is allowing them to have that authority. We can look back at King Saul, for example, and he appointed, or had Samuel appoint Saul, but that was the king that the people wanted. And he drew a stark contrast with that and King David. He's like, okay, you guys had the king that you wanted, now you're going to get the king that I want. But nonetheless, looking back at Paul's rationale and his argument, he's saying that if all authority comes from God, then we have to respect that authority even if we don't like the powers to be. Now, obviously, if that comes in conflict with God's will, like it does in Acts 4 with John and Peter saying that, you know, you guys have worldly authority, but God's authority tells us we have to do this, so we have to answer to him first. Obviously, when there is a conflict between worldly authority and spiritual authority, you go with God's authority on that. But what it's saying is, even when we don't like it, even when they are leaders that God wouldn't necessarily approve of the things that they're doing, we do have an obligation to subject ourselves to their authority because it is an authority that is granted to them by God. And this is something that is not that uncommon or foreign to people that would have had a Jewish background. Because if you're looking all through the Old Testament, there were quite a few times, where God would utilize a worldly authority, even when they were bad people, to accomplish his will. If you're looking, for example, at the siege of both the northern and the southern kingdom, the north by the Assyrians, the south by the Babylonians, in both of those instances, God was saying, you are going to be punished for your sins as a nation. Now, did that mean that everything the Assyrians and the Babylonians did were good and they were the good guys? No, absolutely not. In fact, the Bible is very clear on that. When talking to King Nebuchadnezzar, God essentially says, look, I've given you the ability to conquer all these places, but do not think that that means that you and I, that everything that you do is endorsed by me. And so just because people have authority, just because God uses people in certain ways to have his will accomplished, does not mean he's condoning everything he does. But the point is, their authority does ultimately come from him. And if we are defying their authority needlessly, if we are ignoring the authority that God has granted them, I'm just telling you what the scripture says. It says if we do so, we are endangering our own souls and we are condemning ourselves because we are acting in opposition to authority that is granted by God. So we have an obligation to be good citizens and to do the best that we can to live in peace with all men, which, by the way, it says just a few verses earlier in that same book, that we have to be peaceful citizens that are upstanding, that people can respect. And because God has granted them authority, even if we don't understand it at the time, we also have an obligation to subject ourselves to the worldly authority that they have given, but always with the idea that the reason that we are subjecting ourselves is because ultimately the primary authority that we always answer to, without any question about whether or not that authority is the true authority, is indeed the authority of God. Stay the course, friends.